Identity politics professes to unite oppressed people against their oppressors, but in reality, it merely distracts from the root cause of society's ills. Capitalism could not survive without dividing the working class along the lines of race, gender, and sexuality to prevent a common struggle against the real foe, the rich bosses and the exploitative system they represent. As Ylva Winberg, a leading Swedish communist, explains in this episode, we need united class struggle to strike at the heart of all the rotten and reactionary ideas that poison human relations.
There are many forms of oppression around the world. There's oppression based on color, nationality, gender and sexuality, immigration status, and other categories. Some of these forms of oppression, like the oppression of women, predate capitalism. Marxists seek to create a world free of exploitation and all forms of oppression. The working class is very diverse. Capitalism seeks to divide the working class on all of the categories that I mentioned above, plus more. And we know that the various forms of oppression can create an emotional response by those who are being oppressed. But we argue that we must have a scientific approach to battle and defeat capitalism and eliminate oppression. Socialism will not automatically and instantly end oppression, but it will eliminate the ruling class, which has material interests in maintaining oppression. This topic is extremely important to the working class and to communists around the world. And there's no better comrade to lead off on this but Comrade Ylva from Sweden. Comrade Ylva is a member of the Executive Committee, which is the leading body of the Revolutionary Communist Party of Sweden, RKP. And without further ado, I bring you Comrade Ylva.
Well, the struggle against oppression is a key component of class struggle and has therefore always been a key component of Marxism. Because only if all layers of the working class are drawn into struggle, only a united working class can take power and overthrow capitalism. And this has always been emphasized by Marxists. In 1920, Lenin wrote in Pravda that the proletariat cannot achieve complete victory until it's won complete liberty for women. And again in 1921, in the thesis on work among Communist Party women that was mentioned yesterday in the session on the intern, those theses stated that the Third Congress of the Communist International maintains that without the active participation of the broad masses of the female proletariat and the semi-proletarian women, the proletariat can neither seize power nor realize communism. And that's not just because it's not possible for a minority of the working class to take power. They try to, they would be crushed, and that has happened in history. But precisely also because oppression is one of the main tools the ruling class uses to divide the working class. It's a tool to maintain its rule, to fetter the masses to capitalism. Because if you can convince a part of the working class that their problem is not capitalism, the threat to their livelihoods it is not the attacks by the ruling class, but immigrants, or that women's rights or rights for trans people are a threat to your way of life, your values, your belief, and that you share those values with a part of the ruling class, and that you should line up with religious leaders, conservative politicians, against the part of the working class, then that's an obvious not just for those workers who suffer from women's oppression or racism, but for male workers, for white workers as well. They will not be able to successfully fight against their own oppression, their own exploitation, if they don't realize who their real enemy is. Now, this was pointed out by Marx in relation to English workers and their attitude towards Irish workers. He put it like this. He said, the ordinary English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who lowers his standard of life. In relation to the Irish worker, he regards himself as a member of the ruling nation. And consequently, he becomes a tool of the English aristocrats and capitalists. And he said, the Irishman in return sees in the English worker both the accomplice and stupid tool of the English rulers in Ireland. And he said, this is the secret of the impotence of the English working class. The secret by which the capitalists maintain their power. And the same point what was made by Trotsky in a speech in 1925, where he explained how it's far easier to get English workers to show solidarity with other English workers than with Chinese workers. He says that this is far more difficult because in such a case, you have to break through a shell of national arrogance that has been formed over centuries. And he points out that it's the same with men's attitudes towards women and children, but with the difference that this is prejudice that has been formed not over centuries, but over thousands of. And this is something we see very clearly today. In the epoch of a deep crisis of capitalism, the bourgeoisie are forced to try and divide the working class by any means necessary, because they feel the ground moving beneath their feet. They feel the threat of revolution as hot air against their necks. And so they do their best to try and foment bigotry and nationalism to tie a part of the most backward layers of the working class to themselves, to the system, and against other workers. I recently saw a post on Instagram about a American football player, so-called football. We all know what real football is. You don't throw it with your hands. That's what kids do. But anyway, the Americans call it football. He'd given a speech at a Catholic university, and I didn't see exactly what he said, but it was something about how women should be okay, or they should be allowed not to have to seek a career, but be content with being wives and mothers. And I looked at some of the comments under this Instagram post, and I thought the arguments by those who defended him were a bit indicative. Some of them might have been trolls, probably were, but I don't think all of them were. And someone wrote, this is the NFL today, that is the National Football. They promote Marxism, but they're against traditional family values. And that comment was by a woman. And most comments like that were in the same vein. There is a layer of US workers, I think, and it's similar in other countries, who buy into the idea that trans rights, women's rights, perhaps even Marxism, is a threat towards their religion, American values, family values. Now, where do these ideas come from? They are promoted by the US ruling class, who try to bind them to the idea that they should identify with American patriotism. And they try to invoke the idea that what's wrong in our society, it is not capitalism in decline. No, it's feminism, it's critical race theory, maybe Marxism, which they like to lump together. And they use the hatred that exists against the system and against the Democrats, which in turn uses identity politics to distract them from what's the real problem. Now, we've seen this in every revolution, how the ruling class tries to use religion, bigotry, family, nationalism to turn the backward layers, peasants, petty bourgeoisie in the city, backward workers, against the revolution. In Sudan in 2019, where women played a key role in the uprising, even making up 70% of protesters in the early stages, religion and bigotry was very much used to try and whip up support for counter-revolution. Now, that was not the main reason the revolution failed, the backwardness of the masses. It was because of the leadership of that revolution that were trying to negotiate with the ruling elites that in turn were preparing a counter-revolution. And that counter-revolution turned out to be a lot more well-organized, well-prepared, with a very clear goal. And the leaders of the revolution were not. Had there been a revolutionary party able to lead the masses, things could have played out very differently. And in general, in the midst of revolution, the height of class struggle, the attempts to use oppression to divide the working class will not be successful. And often, even the attempt to try and divide the working class can be the very thing that sparks a mass movement. And we saw this in 2015 in Afghanistan, when the Taliban beheaded 7 people of Hazara origin, and that pushed hundreds of thousands to come out on the streets of Kabul, shouting slogans like, the Taliban does crime and the presidential palace supports them. And Pashtuns and Hazaras are brothers. And this is what Marx and Engels explains in the German ideology, precisely that it's during a revolution where the change of consciousness is on a mass scale is possible, that it's during the struggle to change society that the masses also change themselves. And our role as communists is to explain this, to struggle against racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, and so on within the ranks of the working class, but not in a moralistic way. You're a bad person because you're a racist. No, but by putting forward how they're damaging their own, how they're being used by the ruling class that also oppresses, exploits them, and to put the struggle against oppression on a class basis. But that also requires a very harsh struggle against the petty bourgeois leaders that will tend to dominate in the early stages of class struggle and revolution. And in Lenin's days, in regards to oppression, that meant a struggle against petty bourgeois nationalists and the feminists that were trying to snare proletarian women into supporting them in their struggle to gain the same possibilities as bourgeois men to exploit the working class. Now, this is in essence the same struggle that communists today must wage against identity politics, despite the fact that a lot of feminists today try to sound more radical than the suffragettes. I would argue that they're not. Most of them are locked up in academia. The suffragettes were actually ready to do something. But today they might claim to be left-wing or even Marxist. They might borrow phrases from Marx. But in essence, it's the same ideas that the petty bourgeois elements and bourgeois elements had in the past. The idea of class collaboration, that all women have the same interest. This was expressed by the Swedish feminist Kajsa Ekis Ekman a few years ago. She considers herself to be a Marxist. And she said that feminism is a theory based on the idea that all women share the same interest. She said feminism as a concept is impossible unless you recognize that all women in some way share interest. I would say that's a correct statement about feminism, and that is why we're not feminists. All feminist trends hold on to this core idea. And this idea of common interest is expressed through the idea of separatism and representation, that you can somehow speak for all women if you are a woman, and that all women benefit if a CEO, a president, party leader is a woman. But this was answered a long time ago by Lenin, who said plainly, it makes no difference to the hired worker whether he is chiefly exploited by the great Russian bourgeoisie rather than the non-Russian bourgeoisie, or by the Polish bourgeoisie rather than the Jewish bourgeoisie. And whilst he recognized the need to struggle against national oppression and the horrific anti-Semitism in Tsarist Russia, Lenin denounced the Bund, the Social Democratic Jewish Organization, their claim to have the sole right to speak for all Jewish workers. He said this is completely reactionary, that splitting up the working class along national lines or any lines, men and women, is reactionary and precisely plays into the hands the way the ruling class uses oppression. But this is precisely what identity politics does today. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about radical feminism, queer theory, post-colonialism, intersectionality. They all argue for a division of the movement into a million different organizations, all fighting with each other. Their core argument is the same as the ruling class is trying to convince the workers, that white workers do benefit off of racism, all men benefit off of suppression, and so on. And the women should struggle against the men, the black against the white, and so on. And it doesn't matter that they might call themselves Marxists nowadays, sometimes. In practice, it's the same function as these old feminist leaders of the past, to force the masses of the oppressed to support the careers, the ambitions of these feminists in the state, in corporations, and in academia, using identity like Hillary Clinton, vote for me because I'm a woman. Now, how do we struggle against these ideas? How do we intervene in movements where these ideas are prevalent? Well, it's not by simply denouncing it as reactionary and scream out that communism is the solution. No, as in all questions, you actually have to study the question at hand, learn the Marxist analysis of women's oppression or the Palestinian struggle for liberation, learn how to connect the concrete situation today and connect to the level of consciousness and show the way forward, how communism is the solution and how we must struggle. Lenin said that by putting forward demands for women, he said that we demonstrate that we are aware of the need and oppression of women, and that we are conscious of the privileged position of the men, and that we hate, yes, hate, and want to remove whatever oppresses and harasses the working woman, the wife of the worker, the peasant woman, the wife of the little man, and even in many respects, the woman of the property classes. And it's true, communism will also get rid of the oppression that bourgeois women face as women, but we will also free them of their property. That's why we can't struggle with them, but we have to struggle against them. But the point is, the struggle against capitalism, and we've discussed this throughout the week, the struggle against capitalism for socialism is not just a struggle for bread and butter question. The working class does not arrive at revolution simply through the economic struggle, the struggle for higher wages and better working, but also through the political struggle. And Lenin waged a battle all his life against those who tried to limit the program of the party to economic demands, like in What Is to Be Done, where he's arguing against the economist trend. And in it, he argues against the idea that they put forward, that economic demands is the most effective, always the most effective way of bringing the masses into struggle. And he says this is entirely untrue. Any and every manifestation of police tyranny and autocratic outrage, not only in connection to the economic struggle, is not one whit less widely applicable as a means of drawing in the masses. And he lists a bunch of different situations that can give rise to resentment, anger, and movements, like the corruption of officials, police violence, persecution of religious sects, humiliating treatment of soldiers, students, and liberal intellectuals. And this is very clear if we look at the past decade of radicalization. As in all revolutionary periods, that the struggle takes on many different forms. If we look at Black Lives Matter or the struggle for the right to abortion, yes, anger against the corruption of government officials, or the revolutionary conclusions being drawn by millions around the world in regards to what's happening in Palestine. There's a million different ways in which workers, and youth in particular, move towards revolution. Now, as Marxists, we understand that police brutality or the final liberation for the Palestinians will not happen under capitalism. But our attitude has never been and is not that therefore it's no use taking up this struggle. And all we do when we come to movement is say, well, communism is the answer. And Lenin explained this in an article from 19, where he attacks Bukharin and other Bolsheviks who denounced the struggle for all democratic rights because they said, well, all of this is unrealizable under the epoch of imperialism. He also had the same argument with Rosa Luxemburg, who said the same thing in relation to the right of nations domination. And Lenin says, yes, democratic rights under capitalism remains largely a right on paper, a formal right that in reality will be unrealizable in practice for everyone, or it's just a sham. The right to divorce won't mean that all women will be able to get divorced. But what he says is all democracies in the proclamation and realization of rights, which under capitalism is realizable only to a very small degree and only relative. But without the proclamation of these rights, without a struggle to introduce them now, immediately, without the training of the masses in the spirit of this struggle, socialism is impossible. It's through all struggle, economic and political, that the working class understands the need for revolution and for communism. And communists who refuse to take part in that struggle or intervene with a sectarian mindset, that is, all I have to do is shout about communism and not put forward any concrete steps or demands, will only isolate themselves and leave the movement in the hands of petty bourgeois leaders. Or bourgeois, that will try and limit that struggle to one that is harmless to capitalism. Now, a big reason for why identity politics has been able to penetrate so deeply into the labor and assume a left cover in the past decades is the role played by Stalinism. Real communism would have meant the end of oppression. A communist world would have meant the end of imperialist wars and aggression. It would have meant the end of the struggle between workers for a limited amount of jobs, welfare, houses. The end of the family as an economic unit and institution. Now, this was the aim of the Bolsheviks. The Russian Revolution was only the first step. The Communist International was set up to spread revolution, to lead those revolutions to victory all over the world. And in the meantime, they set about to do everything they could in Russia. They immediately set about to abolish all oppressive laws, discriminating women, children, oppressed nationalities, and so on, introducing the right to divorce, right to abortion, legalized homosexuality. They did their utmost to combat Russian nationalism. And they were very sensitive to the feelings of the oppressed nations. Referring to the nation before the Soviet Union was set up, they simply call it the worker state, removing the name Russia from all documents. And I can't go into depths about it, maybe we'll have more discussion, but it's hard to emphasize enough what a revolution this was in mindset, in culture. Many of the laws that they introduced were only introduced decades later in the advanced capitalist countries. And this was done in the midst of civil war, when the worker state was fighting for survival in an extremely backward patriarchal country, where you had not just a backward attitude of the peasant in particular, but also workers against women, but against Jews, on backward ideas about the raising of children, superstition, nationalism. Yet here a revolution was taking place in culture, all because the working class took power. Now, equality before the law was only the first step. Real equality, social and economic, that was the second. And for women, that would have to mean bringing them fully into production, ending the family as the unit that carries out all household work, by socializing it, by building up daycare centers, communal kitchens, and so on. And Lenin said that the abolishing all these laws, making women equal fully before the law with men, that was the easy part. And he said this again and again, and this is from a speech in 1919. He said, notwithstanding all the laws emancipating, she continues to be a domestic slave because petty housework crushes, strangles, stultifies and degrades her. It chains her to the kitchen and nursery. And real emancipation of women, real communism, will begin only where and when an all-out struggle begins against this petty housekeeping, or rather when its wholesale transformation into a large-scale socialist economy begins. But as Trotsky explained, the Soviet Union isolated was not able to replace the family or erase the inequality that existed between different layers of society or oppressed nations. And with the emergence of the bureaucracy with Stalin at its head, the state is a similar need as the bourgeoisie in the capitalist who base themselves on the family, on bigotry, on great Russian chauvinism, to build a base of support for its own conservatism, and the defense of that conservatism in the communist parties around the world, the betrayal of of what existed in the Soviet Union and Mao's China and so on as real communism. It put off a lot of people who were radicalized in the 60s and 70s, who started to search for new so-called new ideas because of it. And just one example of the kind of things that you could hear from Stalinist party, or Maoist for that matter, is what the Swedish Maoist organization, the KFML bracket R, they love the letters. They wrote in a letter in 1973 as a reply to a question being asked if homosexuals were allowed as members in their organization. And they said that the KFMLR is the organization of politically advanced workers. It is in the front line of class struggle in Sweden. And as homosexuality is an expression of the decadence of doomed class society, it's obvious the homosexual no place in our organization. And they described it at length about how unnatural homosexuality is. It arose with class society. It's an expression of how men hate women. Now you can imagine what young people radicalized thought if they came in contact with these kind of so-called communists. what idea they would have gotten about Marxism and communism. And that's a big reason for why you saw a layer in the post-war period searching for new ideas, saying Marxism needs revising, it needs adding on with feminism and so on. But in reality, these ideas added nothing. These ideas meant an abandonment of the flirtation, whatever flirtation they had had with Marxism and revolution. And the defeat of the revolutions in the 70s sped up this process, made a lot of them conclude that revolution is not possible, communism is not possible, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. And in favor, we must have the small deeds, the small reforms, symbolic gestures. Just an example is there was a Swedish, the main Swedish feminist organization in the 70s. They started out by calling themselves only Marxists, not feminists, because that was bourgeois, they said. They had set up their separatist organization because of their experience as members in Maoist organizations and Stalinist organizations. And in the beginning, they were mainly talking about the conditions for working women and the need to struggle for socialism and communism. They also had a big campaign for the right to abortion, introduced in 1975. But they gradually became more and more conservative and reformist. And towards the end, their only purpose was discussing how it felt to be a woman and create women's art. I think they played a big role in the reason why Sweden has a lot of textile, really ugly textile art. It's a good thing, that at least. But in the search for new ideas, they ended up stumbling into the same old reformist, nationalist, feminist, skeptical ideas of the past. In the search for another explanation of why oppression exists, they ended up with nothing. Yvonne Hirdman, who was a prominent feminist in the 90s in Sweden, she wrote that logic invites us to believe that a general oppression must have a general explanation. Then she says, well, all explanations of women's oppression always is about biology, that it's natural. And then she concludes that we have to leave the origin to the side. We have to realize that the origin is of zero interest, but the origins of oppression is of interest. And the origins of women's oppression was explained in a book by Engels, The Origins of the Family, Private Property and the State. And that gives us the answer to how oppression arose and therefore how we can get rid of it. But identity politics, no matter what kind we're talking about, does not understand what capitalism is or what oppression is. But they simply see it as a set of bad ideas that, for whatever reason, just appeared. That is philosophical idealism. The material world is just a reflection of our ideas or think is ideas. And hence their insistence on which words are being political correct. Endless fighting against others who you think have expressed nasty ideas. And that is how they view the struggle. You have to change people's ideas by yelling at them, and then you change the world. Good luck. But the point is, you can't simply wish away oppression. And Marx, he has a story in the introduction to the German ideology about someone who spent all his life trying to wish away reality. And I think this describes all of these trends. People who buy vegan food really believing that they're going to solve the climate crisis, or people who just spend all their lives shouting at everyone who thinks say bad things. He says in the introduction, once upon a time, a valiant fellow had the idea that men were drowned in water only because they were possessed with the idea of gravity. And if they were to knock this notion out of their heads by stating it to be a superstition, a religious concept, they would be sublimely proof against any danger from water. His whole life long, he fought against the illusion of gravity, whose harmful results all statistics brought him new and manifold evidence. Now, I think some people we should try and save from illusions. And maybe he had a friend who saved his life, was trying to drown. Some of these people, we really should let them drown. Because if we throw them a rope, we're not gonna pull them up. They're gonna pull us down with them. But with all of these ideas, they have given the ruling class another excellent tool to use against the working class. It's used today by the ruling class, both by conservatives who try to portray this as left-wing politics, or even Marxists, to help push ordinary workers into the hands of reactionaries. They say, look, they hate men. They hate white workers. But also it's clearly used by liberals and reformists to try to align a part of the working class to the progressive wing of both conservative and liberal and reformist wings. They try and build a base among the working class, pitting them against each other in a false manner, because both of them defend the capitalist system. Both will use identity politics. Both will use oppression. The Social Democratic Party of Sweden might today say something very feminist and tomorrow something very racist. And conservative parties might on occasion throw up a black party leader and tomorrow attack black workers. Now, I read an article recently. It was from last year where the US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, he was speaking about the need for diversity in the US Army. And he said, we're a diverse nation and our military should look like the nation defense. And I truly believe that diversity makes us stronger. It brings different cultures, different ideas together. And we set a great example for the world wherever we go. I think when a lot of people see statements like this and the way they've really overused identity politics, they've also exposed it. There's a layer of workers and youth in particular who might have looked towards these ideas in the past, but who now see it for what it is, a simple trick, a sham and a diversion attack tactic, and who therefore reject these ideas, who no longer in the US wants to vote for Genocide Joe, no matter he tries to convince people that, well, Trump, he's a threat to the right to abortion. Well, so are you, Sleepy Joe. A layer exists that wants to see them all gone, who are looking towards a genuine revolutionary solution. But they still have to butt heads with an activist layer, particularly in the university, that are fully invested in these ideas. And it's been mentioned, but we've seen this in the encampment movement, how they say that only Palestinians are allowed to speak. In Stockholm, at one of the encampments, not only did they insist that for all the positions, it had to be a non-white person responsible, but a Palestinian activist, she tried to use her identity to bureaucratically take leadership of the movement. She was saying, as a Palestinian, you have to listen to me. You have to do what I say. And at a meeting, she was saying that I am the only Palestinian who has been here from day one. And when she said that, another Palestinian guy timidly put up his hand and said, well, I have been here from day one. Well, she just ignored him and kept going. She was actually expelled from that camp because she was maneuvering and sabotaging everything that she couldn't control. But she still wrote afterwards on social media, they expelled the only Palestinian there. If identity is not the effective way to shut people up, just change the story. In reality, what she was trying to do was to block a competing Palestinian organization, or that she was incompetent anyway, from coming to the encampment. Now, you would have thought that some of these activists would have learned by now. What happens when you say that you're not allowed to question someone who's oppressed when they speak on that oppression, and that they have the sole right to speak on that oppression? This was used by the right wing in the British Labour Party to oust Jeremy Corbyn as party leader, using the claims of anti-Semitism. And now look how anti-Semitism, the claim of it, has been used by the ruling class. Naturally, many have seen through this and completely reject it. But these activists, they still defend the same core ideas. And in order to try and make it fit into their own heads, they then have to paint out Jews as a non-oppressed people. Now, I said it's not enough to simply denounce people as reactionary. We have to patiently explain. But one should be wary of being too patient. As communists, we're not aiming to win over the petty bourgeois activist layers that are heavily embedded in these ideas. And we should not be afraid of being denounced or attacked by them, because fear of being attacked leads to political opportunism. It leads to a political adaptation to their ideas, their words, their terms, and their methods. And Lenin, he warned about this at the second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Party, where the Bundists, they were putting forward a demand. They wanted to add a point to the party program, demanding not just the equality of all citizens, no matter what sexuality or nationality or whatever, but demanding the freedom of languages to counter the idea, as they said, they were arguing that there might be suspicions otherwise that the party has Russifying tendencies. If we don't put it in writing that we respect all languages, we have to say everything in order to avoid being attacked. And Lenin, he comments on this and he says they were like fetish worshippers defending the word and not the principle, acting not from fear of committing in an error in principle, but from fear of what people might say. And he adds that the principle involved here is, should we leave it to the organizations and members of the party to apply the general and fundamental thesis of the program to their specific conditions and to develop them for the purpose of such application? Or are we merely out of the fear of suspicion to fill the program with petty details, minutiae, and repetitions? I think this is something that all communists should think about, because I've seen it many times, and I've seen it in this organization. In some of the discussions that we've had, the comrades want to twist and turn every formulation out of fear that it might be misunderstood by these people who hate us. Isn't this word a little bit politically incorrect? And from that, you start to adopt their words, their terms, and very soon their ideas and methods. It's pointless being a communist if you're afraid of being attacked. What are we about? We're out to destroy capitalism. Of course we will be attacked. And of course these petty bourgeoisies will attack us. It's futile to try and avoid it, unless you want to give up everything and become them. No, we should not be afraid of being communists. But let's be honest, some of these people are not serious people. They might be serious about their academic careers, their political careers. They're not serious about the struggle. And one example, in one of the encampments in Sweden, they organized a yoga workshop to help free yourself from your inner oppression. Good luck with that one. Now, how is that supposed to help the Palestinians? How is yoga going to free Palestine? These people are playing games. And Jordi mentioned it at the session on philosophy. They say this openly. He mentioned an article by Judith Butler, where she said it, let's play. Now imagine Judith Butler going to Palestine and say, let's experiment. I love experimenting. Let's create a new language. Let's play. I saw a similar example in an introduction to what is queer theory in Swedish. And in the end of that book, they give examples of how to conduct a queer struggle. And one of the examples was that a group of lesbians should go to a cafe and make out, because that will provoke and all people think, whoa, what's happening? Maybe this is cool. I don't know what they think will happen exactly, but that's the point, that they're playing games. But Israel's war on Gaza, police violence against homosexuals, women, trans people, this is not child's play. Taking on imperialism, the ruling class of all nations, is not child's play. And we communists, we are serious people. We do not play games. We are not impressed by the scraps and empty phrases offered to us by war criminals and the parasites in power. We're not impressed by their maneuvers and their lies. We see through them and we expose them. We want to overthrow all of them. And we're not going to get that way by playing the sandbox. No, we say like Lenin, let the liars and hypocrites, the dull-witted and the blind, the bourgeois and their supporters, hoodwink the people with talk about freedom in general, equality in general, democracy in general. We say to the workers and the peasants, tear the masks from the faces of these liars, open the eyes of these blind ones, ask them, is there equality between the sexes? Which nation is equal of which? Which class is equal with which? And we say to identity, like Lenin, whoever speaks of politics, of democracy, of liberty, of equality, of socialism, and does not at the same time ask these questions, does not fight against the concealing, hushing up, and gloss over these questions, is one of the worst enemies of the toilers, is a wolf in sheep's clothing, is a bitter opponent of the workers and peasants, is a servant of the landlords and the capitalists. The generation brought up now, that are entering into battle now, that is the generation that will lay the groundwork for the end of oppression, and it will end it the only way possible, as part of the world proletariat, taking power in world revolution. And anyone who wants to see this happen, anyone who understands it must, and I'll look at you in the camera, you cannot wait on the sidelines. You have to get organized now. And we invite you to do so as part of the Revolutionary Communist International to help arm the workers and the youth with the most powerful weapon that has ever been forged in the history of mankind, the ideas of Marxism.
Comrades, that was an excellent lead to our discussion on the question of how to fight oppression. So the first speaker will be Serena, followed by Comrade Francisco from Brazil.
Comrades, the first point I'd like to raise is the importance of marking a clear class line when dealing about the struggle against oppression. So, as you know, in Italy, we have a female prime minister, Giorgia Meloni. Alessandro already spoke about her and her government. She's right-wing, reactionary. She's against LGBT people rights. She's against the right of abortion. She's actually acting against the right of abortion in Italy. So, it's crystal clear she's against women's rights. No doubt. So, yet, among feminists, reformists, left intellectuals, the prominent idea is it's nevertheless progressive to have a female prime minister. And their argument is that female children get used to see women in top position in society. This is the point of liberal bourgeois feminism. Now, I recently read a book from an ex-female Facebook manager, Sheryl Sandberg, whose title is Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. And it's interesting that she doesn't pretend that all women are equal. She's quite honest about it. She says, not all women want career. Many people are not interested in acquiring power. She says, I'm acutely aware that the vast majority of women are struggling to make ends meet. And then she says, if we can succeed in adding more female voices at the highest levels, we will expand opportunities to all. So the point is, give us rich women more power, and somehow everyone will benefit from it. Somehow, maybe. Not only this is false, but whatever they will do or could do from their position of power, it will be an attack against working class women. Their class interests come first, and they have all the material resources to bypass the problem they can face from being women. In the Italian edition of the same book, there is an introduction by another female manager of the ruling class that, talking about her career, she says, I strove to be there for my kids, with a crowd of people around to help me. And then I even got to the point of bringing the children and the nannies, plural, with me on the planes on my business trips. So when I read it, I was, what? Poor thing. So this means they can afford to pursue their class interest. That means that they can promote women's oppression that capitalism needs, while we, working class women, cannot afford not to put the class point in the front line in the struggle against oppression. They are class enemies. The second point I want to raise is the need for a materialist analysis of oppression, the one that was developed by Engels, to engage in a struggle against oppression itself. Last November, there was a movement against violence on women in Italy, unleashed by the assassination, one of the two main assassinations of a young girl by her boyfriend, with spontaneous demonstration expressing the rage among young people against violence on women. But you could see the right-wing government, the reformist opposition and the petty bourgeois postmodernist feminists that all agreed on the same demand, that was courses of sentimental education in the schools. With nuances, of course, so the government wanted policemen and policewomen to teach in these courses. The other ones wanted experts. But anyway, we intervene in this movement with the slogan to eradicate patriarchy, that was a word used in this debate. To eradicate patriarchy, capitalists need to be overthrown. That was our main slogan. But then we developed a transitional demand, such as sexual education courses organized and controlled by the students, so moments of free and democratic discussions, clearly explaining that you cannot fight against violence and oppression starting from the overstructure, such as language, education, and so on. But we need to address the material basis, such as was explained by Engels in The Origin of the Family, the Private Property, and the State. That doesn't mean that we are in favor of sexist language, sexist education, prejudice, and so on, of course. But we must understand the material basis that are in the class division of society. There's an interesting letter by Trotsky from 1923 that is called The Struggle for Cultural Speech to a factory where the workers took the initiative to impose fine against swearing and bad languages. So Trotsky welcomes this initiative. It's a small episode, he says, but he also approaches these episodes as a sign of what happens in the field of culture and language during a revolutionary process. He says, the revolution is in the first place an awakening of human personality in the masses who were supposed not to have no personality. The revolution is, before and above all, the awakening of humanity, its own world merge, and is marked with a genuine respect for the personal dignity of every individual. We saw this also during the Arab Spring, for instance, with the women that were respected during the demonstration, during the movement, the revolutionary movement. So in a revolution, human relationships begin to change. And this is the first step towards a society, the society we are fighting for, a society without any kind of oppression anymore. Thank you.
Thanks, comrade. We got comrade Francisco from Brazil, followed by comrade Stanton from the United States.
Hello, comrades. In Brazil, 68% of people in prison are black. There are almost 1 million black people in jail. 87% of those who are killed by the police are black. And this gives ground to our main slogans in the Brazilian section around this question. It is not a crime to be black, down with the military police. We explain that capitalism, in order to function, developed cruel methods. The ideology for the segregation of human races. You know that racism emerged in the 18th and the 19th century with capitalist development. Pseudosciences were developed by the bourgeoisie and its supporters.
Tal ideologia serviu para explicar o porquê a Europa superava o antigo regime e o Brasil, por exemplo, seguia com a escravidão até 1800.
This racist ideologies helped explain why Europe overcame the old regime while Brazil maintained slavery until 1888.
As intensas e permanentes revoltas sociais arrancaram a escravidão da monarquia luso-brasileira que permanecia com essa.
The constant revolts by the slave masses ended up by abolishing this system by the Luso-Brazilian monarchy.
Porém, não retiraram os negros do cárcere, da miséria e do açoite.
But they still did not free the slaves from misery, from prison and from torture.
No Brasil, a condição subhumana imposta aos negros chegou como regra para a burguesia nativa e o Estado.
The rule for the Brazilian ruling classes and for the state to keep the blacks in semi-slave conditions.
Em 2024, esse sistema mantém os negros usando 40% dos trabalhos informais sem direitos trabalhistas.
And this very same system continues until today, when 46% of blacks work in the informal sector with no rights whatsoever.
Nos é evidente que desde a escravidão até o nosso tempo com assalariamento, fio condutor da exploração negra é o modo capitalista, capitalismo e imperialismo.
The unifying thread for the misery of the blacks is the capitalist system under its different forms from the mercantile system to imperialism.
Mas se não bastasse as violências da burguesia, os negros também passam pela racialização esquerda.
But if it was not enough to deal with the oppression by the ruling class, the blacks also have to deal with the racialization from the left.
Uma sociedade com esses dados chocantes, as chamadas políticas afirmativas de identidade, seduz a juventude negra.
In this dire context, the black youth is won over by the ideas of positive discrimination.
Mas precisamos ir na raiz e denunciá-las.
But we have to go to the root of the matter and criticize this.
Política de identidade desenvolvida 60 pelo Departamento de Estado dos Estados Unidos.
Identity politics was developed in the 1960s by the US State Department.
A partir do plano da Filadélfia.
On the basis of the Philadelphia Plan.
Seu objetivo explícito na raiz dessa filosofia é manobrar o movimento negro.
And the aim of those of these ideas, the explicit aim was to manipulate the black movement.
Controlar revoltas sociais, dividir a classe trabalhadora.
To control the social revolts and to divide the working class.
Lutas individuais ou raciais entre brancos e negros.
And to pit the whites against the blacks.
Por isso, para os comunistas, combater a imposição das raças humanas e as derivações culturais.
This is why for communists it is vital to fight this ideology of human races.
As políticas de identidade buscam mascarar a exclusão e a morte da população negra, a serventia de uma pequena burguesia negra.
The identity politics seeks to conceal the suffering of the black masses at the service of a very very small black bourgeoisie.
Formada pelas cotas liberais.
A bourgeoisie that was developed thanks to the quota system.
Essa camada privilegiada aceita e integrada pela burguesia busca vocalizar todos os trabalhadores no Brasil.
And this very small elite that has been co-opted by the system tries to speak in the name of all the black masses.
E esses intelectuais aprofundam as ideias das raças humanas, forjando espírito e uma essência negra.
And these intellectuals try to justify the idea of races, and they talk about the black identity and the essence of being black.
Espírito negro chamam de negritude.
This black spirit, this idea of being black, came to be known as negritude, as blackness.
Opor a uma essência branca.
A black identity that would be pitted against a white identity.
É a face negra do europeu e reacionário do século.
This is the black face of European romanticism, 19th century reactionary romanticism.
Contraria a igualdade universal entre os humanos e reforça o nacionalismo e o próprio racismo.
That challenges the idea of human universality and fosters particularism and division.
Cabe aos comunistas rasgar o véu desse idealismo subjetivo.
It is the task of communists to stripe this mask of subjective idealism.
Se baseiam em teorias pós-modernas e coloniais.
Based on postmodern ideas and decolonialism.
Eles combatem o racismo.
Communists fight racism.
Com materialismo histórico.
With the weapon of historical materialism.
E programa de expropriação geral da.
And with the program for the general expropriation of the bourgeoisie.
Por isso não queremos cotas.
This is why we do not want quotas.
Queremos universalização do ensino, pleno emprego e moradia digna.
We want universal education, full employment and decent housing.
Não queremos a reforma da polícia.
We don't want to reform the police.
Queremos o fim do braço armado do Estado burguês.
We want to put an end to the armed wing of the state.
Não queremos a essência de povo.
We do not stand for the essence of a people.
Queremos acesso a todas as culturas e a integração dos povos.
We want the openness of all cultures and their intermixing.
Camaradas, a luta dos pretos, indígenas, e todos os segregados.
Comrades, the struggle of the blacks, of the indigenous peoples and all of the oppressed groups.
Pelo capitalismo.
Their oppression by capitalism.
É a luta pela revolução permanente e pelo comunismo nacional.
It's a struggle for the permanent revolution and for world communism.
Ser negro não é crime.
To be black is not a crime. Long live international communism.
Comrade, next we have Comrade Stanton from the United States, and followed by Comrade Ben from the International Center.
I'm from Philadelphia. I had never heard of the Philadelphia Plan, just one of the benefits of being part of an international. I've noticed a trend among young activists in the United States that is a healthy rejection of identity politics when it is obvious. For example, when we're told to vote for Hillary Clinton because she is a woman, or Obama because he is black. But an illusion that somewhere, somehow, there is a revolutionary form of identity politics that can be useful within the movement. Now, in the United States, academics credit the coining of the term identity politics to a 1970s black feminist writers collective known as the Combahee River Collective. And one of its leaders, Barbara Smith, actually shares this same illusion. She said a few years back, quote, "The way identity politics has been used in the last couple of decades is very different than what we intended," end quote. But this is incorrect. We don't base our analyses of ideas and methods on the intentions of those who come up with them, but on their philosophical basis, class standpoint, and political result. With this in mind, the political trajectory of Smith and the other members of the collective can be very educational. The collective self-identified as revolutionary and even socialist, and they ended their 1977 founding statement with the following quote, "I haven't the faintest notion what possible revolutionary role white heterosexual men could fulfill, since they are the very embodiment of reactionary vested interest power," end quote. But since then, the writers of these lines have gone on to, one, be the first lady of New York City, married to Bill de Blasio. Two, endorse Bernie Sanders in 2016. Three, endorse Joe Biden in 2020. And I don't think I need to remind anyone here that all of these three individuals are white heterosexual men. I would hate to hear this group's take on Lenin and Trotsky. Most recently, Barbara Smith has been supporting NATO in the war in Ukraine. Now, I want to emphasize that these liberal political positions aren't accidental. I don't list them to throw mud on individuals I don't like. They flow logically from the starting point of identity politics, the subjective experience of the individual. Instead of starting from a broad collection of data, a wide-ranging examination of the world, and then figuring out the laws that govern it, the method of science and the method of Marxism, identity politics starts at the subjective experience of the individual. Philosophically, this is the starting point of what we would call subjective idealism, the diametrically opposite method of Marxism, dialectical materialism. This incorrect philosophical starting point pretends to have a non-class position and denies the revolutionary role of the working class. But if you don't have a conscious class position, you will unconsciously adapt to the position of the ruling class. This is why when these ideas come up against reality, they only ever end up defending or making good with the status quo, which is capitalism. Revolutionary isn't just something you call yourself. It's a concrete result of the actions you take and the politics you defend. And we can see from this that despite the subjective desires of the Combahee River Collective, their past 40 years in politics is not revolutionary, but reactionary in the extreme. This is just one more example of how idealism in theory leads to reformism or liberalism in practice. In reality, every time that identity politics engages with the movement, it has reactionary consequences. Across the US today, our comrades have been met by the petty bourgeois leaders of the Palestine movement with attempts to silence us because only Palestinians are allowed or we're decentering Palestinians. Now, aside from the fact that a movement to free Palestine that's only limited to Palestinians would be an extremely small movement, we should ask which Palestinians are allowed in this movement. The Palestinian Authority? The PA literally plays the role of the police organ for the Israeli state in the West Bank. Instead of that, the workers of the whole world, regardless of their nationality, race, or gender, should take on this movement to defend Palestine by ending worldwide imperialism. There is no uniform identity in society. Within any one identity, such as Palestinian, there are right-wingers and there are communists. And ultimately, these ideological differences reflect different classes. Marxists use the term progressive to define anything that unites the working class and teaches it of its strength. We define reactionary as anything that divides the working class and confuses it. This is why all forms of identity politics are reactionary, regardless of their intention. They teach us of the interests of the individual self and not the collective whole, and they completely blind us to the class divide that objectively exists in society. There's no such thing as a revolutionary identity politics, not because it hasn't been found yet, but because it can't exist. Thank you.
Next, we have Comrade Ben from the International Center, and is going to be followed by Comrade Danny.
Hi, comrades. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Comrades have talked about the Palestine encampments. Well, in Dublin Trinity, the student union also said only Palestinian voices can be heard. And so they asked the two Palestinians what they thought should be the main demand of the encampment. And they thought about it a little bit. And they said, death to all Israelis. it put the student union in a slightly awkward. That's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about the Lenin's polemics against the Jewish Bund in his day. Now, at the end of the 19th century, the position of the Jews in Russia was horrific. Up until 1917, they still lived under feudal restriction in Russia. But decaying capitalism was also making the entirety of Europe a hostile place for the Jewish people. And so the Jews felt trapped. And this led to a polarization amongst the Jews of the Russian Empire. Many Jews joined the revolutionary movement. Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, they're all of Jewish background, very high proportion. But feeling trapped under capitalism, a layer of the petty bourgeois and bourgeois Jews began dreaming of this utopia, of Zionism, of a safe Jewish state in historic Palestine. But many of the, you also had a layer of middle-class Jewish intellectuals that joined the Marxist movement. And they brought these petty bourgeois nationalist prejudices with them into the movement. And this was expressed by the leaders of the Jewish Bund. And they argued, like the Zionists, that anti-Semitism was this ahistorical thing. You know, for the Zionists, anti-Semitism is a product of Gentile society going back to the Roman Empire, rather than being a product of specific classes, the landlords and the capitalists, who were spreading this anti-Semitic trash. In a similar way that the modern proponents of identity politics, they abandon a materialist analysis. They blame white people in general for the oppression of black people, men in general for the oppression of women, straight people in general for the oppression of LGBT people, and so on. And just like the modern identity politics crowds, the Jewish Bund concluded that in order to be free from this oppression, it was necessary for the Jewish workers to have their own organization. And so they arrived at the Second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party in 1903, and they demanded a federal structure for the party where they would have independence to represent Jewish workers. And so important did Lenin regard this question that he insisted it be placed as the first item on the agenda. Because if you accept that the Jewish workers have their own structures, the Finnish workers theirs, the Russians theirs, the Polish theirs, then it would represent the complete negation of the centralized revolutionary party. Now, we know that Lenin had a very sensitive policy on the national question. He fought for the right of nations to self-determination, including the right of separation, which incidentally is impossible to apply to the Jews because they weren't concentrated in a single territory. But he completely opposed separatism within the labor movement. Now, does this seem contradictory? Well, first of all, we should note that the revolutionary party is not a model of the future revolutionary society in miniature. Just like the saw and hammer don't look like the chair that they are created to create, you know? The revolutionary party is not a little miniature version of a future socialist society. Yet you have many of these petty bourgeois elements associated with identity politics and nationalism and so forth that come into the party thinking, what can the party do for me and my liberation in a narrow sense? And expect that it is the job of the leadership to basically create a safe space environment to police the membership and so forth and create such a situation. But the role of a revolutionary party is not to be that miniature future society, but to be the tool that can bring that society about. And back to the position of Jewish workers, it was that the task of the Russian Revolution was to end the oppression of the Jewish working class, which required uniting workers from all backgrounds, Jews, Poles, Latvians, Russians, in one single centralized party in order to overthrow Tsarism, without which self-determination and the freedom of any group would have been a utopia. There's a close analogy, actually, between the struggle for national self-determination, the national question, and identity politics and this question of oppression. For the bourgeois of the oppressed peoples, yes, they are oppressed, but what do they want? They want freedom and equality to also enjoy in the exploitation of the masses, like the bourgeois of the oppressor nation, which means they don't want to overthrow this system as a whole. They want to liberate their particular group. They put their national identity first, their oppressed group first, of which they claim the exclusive right to represent. We fight against oppression, of course, but we do so with our own class methods. And in all cases, we subordinate this question to the general interests of the proletariat and the fight for socialism.
Thanks, comrade. Our next speaker will be Comrade Nani from Spain, followed by Comrade Karim from Pakistan.
Well, comrades, I wasn't planning on intervening in this commission until I got to Italy. But just as we arrived here, we received notice of a political attack on us in Seville on behalf of a trans person in the encampment in Sevilla who got us expelled from the encampment. Had nothing to do with insults or anything like that. Our comrades were political leaders of this encampment at this university. And this person who was a part of the student leadership was just very dishonest and was boycotting the work, had nothing to do with gender, and was eventually expelled from this student's commission by the rest of the commission. And so when our comrades were participating in the encampment this week, this person complained before the security committee of the encampment, accusing our comrades of being transphobic. And they then barred a comrade and a couple of sympathizers from attending the encampment. We have to say that this expulsion from the encampment was supported by our ex-comrades of the communist left, revolutionary left, and to their shame and eternal damnation. And we're going to respond with the public article where we will denounce them. Because this is an absolutely intolerable situation. We have to respond. And it's not a question of theory, then. It's really a practical question. And the way that identity politics is used to attack and divide the movement in the most dishonest way. But I also wanted to mention that we recently had a meeting of the Spanish section CC. Because with our rapid growth and the way that the organization is changing, lots of new young people joining, the pressures of identity politics are growing and we have to combat it constantly. So we had a meeting, a very fruitful meeting with Comrade Jordi, and we've discussed having a series of political education meetings to discuss all different aspects of identity politics. And in particular, an aspect which is particularly important in Spain, which is this question of inclusive language. Because every left tendency, from the most reformist to the most radical, has fallen not only into identity politics, but into this question of inclusive language. As you may know, in a wide range of languages, the neutral gender in the language tends to coincide with the male gender. So among these sectors, there's efforts to sort of have neologisms change the language, to change the words, to avoid using any gendered pronouns or language whatsoever, which renders texts and discussions, frankly, unintelligible. So we have a firm position on this. We don't accept these neologisms into our documents, into our manner of expression, while of course being very sensitive to particular situations, but generally speaking, it's a divisive question within the working class and in the struggle for women's equality. And which generally speaking is not a problem which exists among working class women. We recently had a big struggle amongst the women home workers who take care of children or the elderly. They organized an encampment themselves, denouncing their conditions. And when the media interviewed them, they used, without any, you know, without thinking about it, the Spanish the Spanish grammar, which includes, you know, this gendered language. So our task is to denounce capitalism, to denounce the conditions that we're forced to live under. But this question of you know, inclusive language is something that just divides the movement. We're not linguists. We're not, you know, anthropologists. We you know, perhaps the origins of the neutral gender is rooted in machista culture in the past. But it's not our job to tackle this. It's the job of future generations, of future society, which where the language will reflect the changes that will take place in human societies. I did want to mention briefly the question of machismo violence against women, which in the Spanish state is a particularly big problem.
And I think we need to take this up not just ideologically and programmatically, but also practically. Because no left tendency has really come up with concrete proposals for how to objectively confront this situation. And so, although there are activists who will put their bodies on the line when it comes to preventing evictions from homes and so on. And so organizations and unions in particular, they need to organize concrete physical action to prevent this kind of violence against women in their neighborhoods. They have to denounce abusers, they have to organize demonstrations in front of their houses and call attention to it. So that when women are participating in their unions and their tenants associations, they can also find support on this kind of issue as well.
Thanks, comrades. Our next speaker is going to be Comrade Karim from Pakistan, followed by Comrade Ravi.
Last December, when participants of the Long March from Balochistan entered Islamabad, they were severely repressed by the state institutions and denied the right to peaceful protest. But on the basis of the solidarity expressed by the working class from all over Pakistan, especially from the Punjab, the state not only withdrew from violence, but also gave them the right to protest peacefully in Islamabad. It is indeed an expression of the strength and solidarity of the working class. Ruling class uses identity politics to create artificial divisions just to blur the important and fundamental class question. As communists, we put blunt ideological critique of identity politics, but it doesn't mean that the questions on which the identity politics are being done either do not exist or have already disappeared. For example, if you talk about the national question within the whole world, from backward regions of the world to some developed regions, the national question still exists. In our discussions, we often describe Pakistan as a prison for the oppressed nationalities. On this hand, we recognize the existence of the oppressed nationalities over there in Pakistan. But why do we think of nationalism? Nationalism is the not the question, the solution to the identity, the oppressed nationalities questions. Sorry. Because the crisis of the capitalist system has become reactionary, so the ruling class and their ideas have become completely reactionary. Another important thing is that nationalists try to deny an important and historical fact that the class antagonism does not exist in the oppressed nationalities. And we have no working class. It is basically unscientific and reactionary thinking. And also this is a Stalinist creation. But it is clearly mentioned in Communist Manifesto that the history of the humankind is, till today is the history of class struggle. As we have been discussing the importance of philosophy and ideology for the last 3 days, understanding society, nature, and contradictions requires a correct perspective. Based on the facts, we can draw the correct line of action. Nationalism or other ideologies have no power to analyze the society. That's why they cannot draw the correct line of action also. On the basis of which the same ideas go to two extremes where people become victims of adventurism or opportunism. It is of utmost importance that nationalism and the national question are two different things. And we have historical evidences for the solution of the national question. In what ways has the national question been historically resolved? At present, all the nationalist leadership of the oppressed nationalities in Pakistan are bowing down to the framework of the so-called global imperialist institutions like United UN. And on the basis of the participating in the programs of these so-called global imperialist organizations and NGOs, they put their nations behind the truth that we are fighting for your case, which is actually just opportunism. To solve the national question in the whole world, including Pakistan, it is inevitable to connect with the socialist revolution. And it is a historical compulsion that democratic question in society like Pakistan are impossible without a socialist revolution. Apart from this, all other ways are just a waste of time. That's why we invite those who fight against every form of oppression that they should come and understand the basis of oppression, why oppression is happening here. And until we have no understanding of the basis of oppression, until we cannot even determine our correct path. Thank you.
We've got next, Comrade Ravi, followed by Comrade Watsala from Sri Lanka.
the British section. Identity politics isn't a new idea, but a very old and colonial idea. It was used extremely effectively by the British Raj. Following decades of nationwide protests, the British diffused these movements with roundtable talks. The British had all the power at the center and divided it around the table. They divided it amongst caste Hindus, who were represented by the Congress Party, Muslim delegates, Sikh delegates, Anglo-Indian delegates, Christian delegates, and depressed classes. All the community leaders could never agree on major issues, and the facade of equal representation kept all the power in the hands of the British. This colonial legacy exists and continues in and was written into India's constitution, especially for the Dalits, who are known as untouchables. They are the most oppressed layer in South Asian society. And communists are always criticized, such as authors like Arundhati Roy, who say communists force-fit reductive Marxist analysis into India. They deliberately mistake and distort what class is. Class is a social relationship to the means of production, not an identity. And the exact origins of caste are debatable, but the evidence shows it is clearly rooted in society, likely arising in the Gupta period. In the historic record, when the Greeks came to India, Alexander the Great noted seven castes, but did not mention untouchability in the historic record. But in the 5th century BC, a Chinese pilgrim wrote about the Chandalas, and he said that they live outside the village and deal with meat and flesh. Whenever they enter the town, they strike a piece of wood to announce their arrival so others may avoid them. Clearly, in this period, there was a development which led to caste arising. Compare this to B.R. Ambedkar, the writer of the Indian Constitution, who writes that caste is the natural outcome of certain religious beliefs which have the sanction of the Shastras. But Mr. Ambedkar, why were these religious ideas able to take hold? At what stage did they develop? How did they develop? Because ideas are just ideas, but for them to have a deep hold in society, they must have a social basis. I have to sum up now. But representation politics has been a complete disaster in India. It's not been progressive at all, and has only helped what they call in India a creamy layer. Narendra Modi himself is a other backward caste. The Dalit parties and their leader Mayawati completely enriched herself whilst in power, alienated her voter base, and won no seats in the parliamentary elections last week.
Thank you, comrade. We have comrade Watsala from Sri Lanka, followed by comrade Marie from Denmark.
I'm here to, I think most of the points were excellent and many of the things were already discussed. So I'm here to bring in some experience from the Global South, as they call us now. I'm from a country where you have so many humanitarian aid programs to eliminate, you name it, like this crisis and that crisis and everything. They're spending millions and millions of money simply strategizing how to create priority criteria. In 2022, we had a mass uprising. And within this mass uprising, they had the audacity to write another report, which titles Sri Lanka Multidimensional Crisis, Humanitarian Need and Priorities, which according to them, and honestly, these facts, like the statistics, I find really interesting. 7 million people were in need. And what were they in need? They were in need of food, nutrition, water, health, protection, and education, which are the basic needs of people, and the so-called humanitarian needs priorities, the targeted crowd of their program is 3.4 million. And they say that they have reached around 3. But what have they done actually by reaching to these people? What do they actually mean by reaching people? It simply means that you have elaborated project proposals and concept notes developed with all glorified words, can by no means understand these general masses who don't have food to eat in their plates and to feed their kids, but a sheet of attendance to kind of number down the number of beneficiaries. And that's it. And it really doesn't mean that it actually addresses the issue of hunger or poverty or anything that these people are affected from. The USAID itself, during the performance period of September 2022 to June 2023, they say that they're going to have an estimated total cost of 7 million rupees that they try to put into school feeding. Because apparently we have school students who are falling down, fainting in the lines, trying to be in the school. But the only thing that they do is they give a packet of rice, some kind of dal, a tin of salmon, and that's it. Which leads to the question of these priority indexes are being made to also scrutinize, among these poor poverty layer of whom these packet of rice and packet of, dal is going to. And honestly, these ideologies, especially like identity politics and this intersectionality and all of these, are made in a way to justify to whom this packet of rice is going to. And then we have a parliament who talks relatively about rights. On the same time, they're passing bills to prevent the speech, the protest, and the ability to actually talk your mind. And also in the same time talk about, are we going to decriminalize homosexuality? Which is going to pit people against each other. It makes it impossible for the people to understand that we are having and fighting against the same monster. They make elaborate, emotional, sad speeches, shed a tear a bit, have a small band-aid. When the masses in the streets are getting bombarded by water cannons, by tear gas, by bullets and ammunition. And that's why, comrades, I think we need to head on fight these ideas, because these lunatics with these crazy ideas has already a platform to, give these speeches and everything. And when we have places where our voices are small, it's really important that we fight these ideas firmly and strongly, because that's how we are going to stand strong, and also that's how we are going to reach out to people to say, this is not the method, but it's the class method that we need to take. Or else we are giving the power to these petty bourgeois layer of leaders to do as they wish, and to demoralize an entire set of masses who only see these leaders as even saying something about themselves and actually follow these wrong methods. And also, at the end of the day, we are Marxists. It's our tradition to fight these wrong ideologies with our heads on. And that's what we need to do, and that's what we have to do as well.
Thanks, comrade. Next, we have comrade Marie from Denmark. And if we have time, we're going to have one more speaker, comrade Sarah from Britain. And I apologize to those comrades who didn't have the time.
When we look across the world today, we see hundreds of thousands of young people waking up to fight oppression. They feel this existential crisis of capitalism seeping out in all pores of society. Sexism, transphobia, racism, all these disgusting things. And it makes people so angry and frustrated, and they want to fight. So we have to look at, if we want to fight oppression, how do we do it? What actually works when we look at history? And people have talked and talked and talked for hundreds of years. And still, in the most equal countries on earth, like Scandinavia, we do not have equality. We have full equality for the law, but we still have oppression, sexism, racism, all these things. And I think as communists, we have to reclaim our heritage. Our name has been blackened by Stalinism, as Ylva said. But I don't think there has been one single event in world history that did more for the liberation of women than the Russian Revolution. That was actually liberation and fight against oppression in real life, concretely. It was the Russian Revolution in Petrograd. It was the Russian working women in Petrograd who started the revolution in 1917. They went onto the street on Women's Day to strike and got the men to join them in the fight. And within a few days, they had toppled the Tsarist regime and then began the fight, not just for equality in law, but for real social equality. And in this period between February and October, Lenin and the Bolsheviks stressed again and again the need to mobilize the women. Lenin, he said, without the women, there can be no successful revolution. And it was only because they succeeded in this that the Russian Revolution actually conquered in October. And immediately the Russian Revolution and the Bolsheviks, they took all the steps to equality. And I think now, 100 years later, it is still the most progressive steps that has ever been taken. As Ylva mentioned, they removed all laws that banned inequality. They gave the right to abortion. Still today, in the freest country in the world, the USA, you don't have the right to abortion. The right to divorce, they introduced maternity leave. That is also something that you could just dream of in many countries of the world today. And this sent shockwaves around the world. It's not a coincidence that there was a wave of women's rights being introduced in the capitalist world after the Russian Revolution, because they feared what inspiration it would create. But the Bolsheviks were also very clear that equality before the law is actually just the first step. That what is needed, you don't create equality just by writing on a paper we have equality. It needs for the social, economic, and cultural base to change radically. And that is why the fight for equality and the fight against oppression can only be a fight for communism. Because you need to change the social basis, the thing that is the root for oppression. And that is the private property of the capitalist and the landlords. If we want to create equality, we need to remove what Lenin called the house slavery of women. In a country like Denmark, where most women work, women still work 1 hour more every day on household chores. So what do we want to do about it? We can fight until the end of time who do the dishes, and we should share the housework, obviously. But we don't just want to share the shitty work. We want to remove it. We want to socialize it. But that requires that we change the base of society. It requires we nationalize the means of production. And that is also the basis for a change in culture. Right now, there is this movement around fight against sexism and so on, which is really good. It shows the mood in society. But there's also the other move, the more extreme right-wing chauvinism growing up. And in order to fight this, of course, we go into all these fight against these right-wing bastards. But we also have to understand, why is a culture like it is? Why is a discourse like it is? Why do the words that are being used? Where does all this poison come from? We are materialists. The culture, all these things, it comes from the material base. It comes from thousands of years of oppression. If we are to remove it, we have to remove the roots of it, which is class society. And that is why a fight against oppression is absolutely linked to the fight for communist society.
Thanks, comrade. Our last speaker before the summit will be Comrade Sarah from Britain, unfortunately with a shortened amount of time.
Okay, comrades, I don't have much time, so I will try and be concise with my point. I think the comrade from the US made a very good point about the way that identity politics is being gone beyond. But of course, the limits of how this is being gone beyond and the need for us to explain to our whole ranks everything which is being said in this discussion. But the point I wanted to make is that some people, those on the left, think that it is our job to answer every point made by the reactionaries. And in Britain, we have this slogan, which I'm sure much of the international uses, that we must fight the culture war with class war. But I think we need to understand what this means. What this means is that we bring back the question when the culture war is put to us, to the class questions, to what is important. Ylva correctly said that we do not just shout about communism, but we must put forward concrete steps. And this is, of course, entirely true. But there are those on the left who use this idea of not leaving everything until, you know, the final socialist revolution as an excuse and as a trap to enter into the culture war. And as we know, this helps nothing and it is not our method. So what this slogan means to me is when the culture war is used against you, you raise the class question and you expose why the culture war is being used. I'm sure all comrades have seen Fiona's takedown of Suella Braverman. And I think this is a perfect example of how to do this. Suella Braverman called her and the whole Palestine movement anti-Semitic. And what did she do? She didn't get bogged down. She didn't get bogged down in this question and try and constantly prove that we aren't anti-Semitic. But she said, this is ridiculous and we must discuss the real issues. Why are you saying this? And she proved that the Tories do not care about anti-Semitism, but that they only care about using it for their own interests. And I think when people ask these questions in good faith, when they raise these questions of oppression in good faith, we must, of course, explain the history, but we must raise the concrete demands now. Healthcare, proper housing to be able to remove women from abuse situations. Because the point for us is not to win a debate against the right-wingers. This is not a university debate club. The point for us is to raise the ideas in a way which attracts the layer, the best layer out there that we are looking for. And as has been said, that best layer are starting to go beyond these ideas of identity politics. So we should use this to our benefit by not feeling that we need to get bogged down in these culture war debates, but by constantly bringing the question back to the class questions and explaining to our ranks the pernicious role that identity politics plays and to stop ourselves from ever falling into the trap that the right wing sets for us. Thanks. I had more to say, but I'll leave it there.
Thank you, comrade. Thanks again to all the comrades for the discussion. And now Ylva will sum up the discussion.
Thank you, comrade. I think it's been a very, very good discussion. And I think a lot of comrades have really showed how reactionary identity politics is and many different concrete examples of how it's used to really only further the career of a small layer of the oppressed to become part of the bourgeoisie. Now, a comrade in the Swedish section, she said to me once, it's this idea of representation. And like Serena said, like, everybody will benefit if more women are rich. It's like trickle-down economics. Everything that's good for the rich, well, it will somehow be good for the rest of us. But all they do is talk and talk and talk, as what Sawa said from Sri Lanka, while they're making the masses fight each other over the crumbs. No, but we need to fight them for the whole cake. And Ben, he raised an important point in relation to the Bund, that the Revolutionary Party is not a model of communism, but the tool to overthrow capitalism. And I've seen it a lot of times that comrades, they say, yes, yes, of course, it's not the model, it's the tool. But in their thinking, there's still remnants of this idea that the organization still somehow can be an isolated island, that we can keep a wall around the organization, that Marxism is an absolute vaccine against oppression and prejudice coming into the organization. But we are building not with the future humans, but the humans of today. And yes, we will have cases and have had of prejudice, of violence, of harassment being done by one comrade to another. Now, how do we react to that? Well, Tom said it in his introduction, by not reacting in an emotional way, but by an objective and scientific way, by thinking from the principles of Marxism. Because what happens when you don't, when you react in that emotional way? You lend yourself to these petty bourgeois elements, damaging the organization. This idea in identity politics, an oppressed person is always right. If we adapt to that idea, which easily happens if you react in an emotional way, then you won't treat these cases in a Marxist way, but you will very easily end up adapting to whatever methods that petty bourgeois people believe and demand that we should have. And that's a very dangerous thing, because we can't be naive here. Nani showed a concrete example We have many enemies, not just the bourgeoisie and the bourgeois state, not just the identity political academics, but embittered old comrades, ex-comrades, other political organizations on the left that will be happy to use anything to take us down. And the state and the bourgeoisie will be happy to use these elements, to use anything to sow discord within the revolutionary movement. So no, we're not an isolated island, and we treat cases in a serious way, not an emotional way. Now comrades have shown how, like I said before, how these identity political people, they have really used it to further their own career. And we've seen this in Sweden. Feminism became a widespread establishment phenomena 20, 30 years ago. All parties all of a sudden were feminists. At the same time as they started attacking a lot of these reforms that had given a better life to women. In the 60s and 70s, when the Social Democrats carried through a lot of these reforms, they were not called feminists. But then when they started cutting the welfare, all of a sudden, we're feminists. But what has the real result been? What has been the step forward for women with this? Well, like we have said throughout this discussion, it's created an industry, a layer of petty bourgeois women who have been given a career within the state and academia to produce book after book, text after text, report after report, some maybe not so horrible things, statistics about gender inequality. Of course, that doesn't change anything. Some endless reports about how can we force boys to wear pink and girls to play with toy cars. But some very openly reactionary stuff. An example is a former president of a university in Stockholm, Moira von Wright. She published a report on how to get women more interested in science. And her conclusion was scrap science. She said that a physics that is gender aware and gender sensitive presupposes a relational point of view, and that a large part of the traditional scientific knowledge is removed. In the same report, she's horrified that a school book on science dismisses the idea that there is a treasure at the end of the rainbow. And she says that this view only approves of objective knowledge, horrible, and dismisses the fairy tale, science is so evil, and thousands of years of life wisdom. Apparently for thousands of years, human beings have found a treasure at the end of the rainbow until evil science came along and said, nope. And she's also upset that another school book dismisses astrology as unscientific. And she says this might put off women from studying physics. So that's what physics is supposed to do, I guess. Which month are you born in? Are you a Capricorn? Born in the fifth house of the seventh sun, or whatever they say. One point I wanted to raise that I didn't go into in the lead-off is that, and it was touched a bit upon in the discussion, is that sometimes you'll hear feminists say, well, you think everything's going to be solved after the day after the revolution. When in reality, it's really, if you read Lenin, Trotsky, any Marxist, none of them ever said that. For example, what Lenin wrote in The Right of Nations to Self-Determination. He said, even now, probably for a fairly long time, proletarian democracy must reckon with the nationalism of the great Russian peasants. And then he added, in brackets, not with the object of making concessions to it, but in order to combat it. When you read Lenin and Trotsky, you can't find a trace of any kind of romantic view of the transition to socialism. All human relations will be perfect. No. Now, it's not true for all Bolsheviks. If you read Kollontai, for example, I don't recommend you do. There is a text, I don't know what the title of, Love of the Working Bees? I don't know. I don't remember what the title is in English. But she describes a story of the changed relationships after taking power, where a woman finds out that her daughter is now together with her boyfriend, and she's very upset about it. And then the daughter, like a good communist, according to Kollontai, lectures her mother, we have free love now. We do not consider other human beings as property. And this was her view of the new changed relationships. Some had that view, others panicked about the falling apart of the old family, the rise in divorces. And when you read Lenin and Trotsky, they would argue against both these reactions. In From the Old Family to the New, Trotsky explains that the breakup of the old family was happening at a faster rate than the development of new relationships. And he had some very concrete examples of what this could look like. And I want to read two of them out because I think they're very typical of what you would see. One was the husband, torn away from his usual surroundings by mobilization, changed into a revolutionary citizen at the civic front. A momentous change. His outlook is wider, his spiritual aspirations higher. He is a different man. And then he returns to find everything at home practically unchanged. The old harmony and understanding with the people at home is gone. No new understanding arises. The mutual wondering changes into mutual discontent, then into ill will. The family is broken up. An old family, 10 to 15 years of common life. The husband is a good worker, devoted to his family. The wife also lives for her home, giving it all her energy. But by chance, she comes in contact with the Communist Women's Organization. A new world opens up before her eyes. Her energy finds a new and wider object. The family is neglected, the husband is irritated, and the wife is hurt in her newly awakened civic consciousness. The family is broken up. And this is very common. It's not like in all revolutions and strikes, class struggle, that everybody changes and then all couples are very happy, they respect each other, they do everything for each other. No, it's a painful process. And it was certainly very painful in the Soviet Union. It won't be a love parade. And another point related to this, and I'll finish on this, is a point on culture that has been raised by Alan, where he said comrades should read novels, poetry. When you read Trotsky, you can tell he has a high cultural level. He was called the pen, after all. And I think you can see it in these quotes. Because one thing that reading poetry and literature does, it helps you to go from the general to the particular. You see beyond abstract theory, or rather fills it with concrete substance, deepens it. The revolution stops being an abstract concept, devoid of life. You see behind it the living world in full color, the millions of men, women, and children struggling, loving, hating, dreaming of a better life, real, living, and breathing human beings. And you won't understand a revolution or a strike if your thinking is abstract and dry. What did Lenin say about what happens in a strike? It's quoted in the first volume of the Lenin biography, that workers cease to be slaves and start to become human beings. And this is even more true for revolutions. In one of my favorite books, which is about the development of the working class in Stockholm. There is a working class woman who is very conservative. She cares for her children. She doesn't like it when her husband goes on strike. She's worried about the finances of the family. And then one day, she surprises everyone when she says, isn't it enough already? Shouldn't we go on strike? And this is very typical. It's a common story. Many mothers will often be quite conservative, especially if they're housewives, isolated, but even those who work, because they have the responsibility of the family, main responsibility of caring for the children. It makes them more careful, don't like it if their children become political, but that can turn into its opposite. The rage of what the society is doing to their children becomes revolutionary, directed against capitalism. And like Alan often says, quoting the Bible, the first shall be the last shall be the first. Some of these most conservative layers become the most revolutionary, like the women in the Russian Revolution, the most brave, that confronted the soldiers, grabbed their guns, pleaded with them and yelled at them, don't shoot at us, join us. And that is the same thing we see today. Young girls, women oppressed, being radicalized, entering into the struggle. And we aim to give the revolutionary aspirations of these layers and all those who are drawing revolutionary conclusions, an organized and conscious expression, starting with the youth, the most advanced layer, to build the base necessary to penetrate the masses. But as all comrades have said, this will only be possible if we don't adopt an inch of identity politics, but stand firm in Marxism. Thank you.